You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
G'day, Annie McLaughlin here for this week's edition of Stick Together, the only national program focusing on union news, worker stories and social justice issues. This program is produced in Melbourne for 3CR and broadcast across the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation on the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
We must dismantle white supremacy in all its forms, and we must make sure that we tackle racism in all its forms as well. We must never stop organizing, we must never stop resisting, and we must never stop fighting for justice. And I'd just like to end by quoting from one of my favorite people, Angela Davis, who says, "In a racist society, it is not enough to be a non-racist. We must be anti-racist." And there is a big difference, there is a big difference. We know that we can't change history. We know history is what it is. But we can make things right now and for the future. Thank you so much, everyone, for your solidarity and your unity.
That was Senator Maureen Faruqi, Deputy Leader of the Federal Greens, speaking at the recent anti-racist rally in Naarm, Melbourne. We will hear more from the anti-racist rally in Naarm on the 26th of September, which was backed by 10 unions, amongst others, to emphasise that anti-racism is union business. But first, we hear from Caterina Chiani from the United Workers Union, the UWU, talking at the Eco-Socialism Conference in September about organising migrant workers and the common interests of workers of all national backgrounds.
I probably want to just talk a little bit about the fact that I've both lived and grown up in this community, and also that my family and my parents came from a migrant background, non-English speaking, migrated to Australia and worked in a factory not very far from here where workers lost their job through the tariff cuts in Australia and through the neoliberal agenda. I actually really wanted to kind of talk a little bit about, and it's been playing a lot on me, about the rallies, the racist rallies from last week, especially as a person who grew up in a non-English speaking household. And I wanted to share some lessons about organising workers and building unity across the working class. For those of you that know a little bit about the farm organising team, we started 10 years ago looking at the agricultural sector and made a decision in the union that I came from to organise farm workers. And farm work is, you know, divided into kind of three different groups of workers. There are workers who, all of it is migrant work, all of it. There are workers who migrated to Australia many, many years ago and are part of like the kind of permanent migrant community in Australia. There are workers who work on visas, with and without visas. There are very big communities of undocumented workers. The ones that Donald Trump is deporting in America are members of our union here in Australia. And there's also seasonal workers, which come from the Pacific and come into and out of Australia over a few months. So when we first looked at this area in terms of organising, the majority were casual and insecure work, but actually not out of seasonality, it's more out of exploitation. It was a cash contractor model. Farmers were paying cash contractors, were engaging them to then employ mass workforce, maybe sometimes two, three different cash contractors employing hundreds of workers. There was rampant wage theft. People were being paid as low as $12 to $14 an hour. And there was modern slavery in that their connection with their contractor wasn't just about how much money they were being paid. It was everything from how to get to the farm. You were transported in small vans that you paid the privilege of to the contractor. You were housed in accommodation 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, paying $100 a week per person to the contractor, who also was your landlord. So it was a very exploitative model. There were no penalty rates, so the union movement can talk all about protecting penalty rates. Mm-hmm. Then none existed in that award. And people were paid by piece. You were paid by how much you picked, which meant people earned below the minimum wage. So we had seasonal workers because of that. They also had to get their deductions in terms of like their airfares to Australia. We had workers who would have $0 on their pay slip, -$50, -$100 after a week of work.
Shame.
And sexual exploitation was considered part of the job. The rumours just across the sector, you know, you'd go to a farm in Mildura and it would be the farm owner's son in this workplace exploits women from this community, is well known by everybody. So our farm members over the last 10 years have organised and formed their union in these very difficult circumstances and have smashed every single one of those issues. Every single one. And 3 weeks ago I held a training session with our farm leaders in Noble Park. Every single one of those farm leaders was a cash contractor. The majority of them did not have work rights and were on insecure visas. They are all now directly employed, paid above the minimum wage. They have secured either work rights. Some of them through our union migration clinic have actually won permanent residency. And some of them were the leaders of the first farm strike in Australia for in decades. I talk a lot about this sector. I talk about this sector having been forgotten by the union movement. And it was. And that is a bit about union resources and about unions walking away from parts of the industry. But actually, if I was very truthful about the situation in this sector, some of it is actually about racism.
Yeah.
Some of it is about the fact that this industry, agriculture, just like many, many other industries, and I could point to lots of others in our union and across many other unions, for a long period of time transitioned from a predominantly English-speaking workforce to a non-English-speaking workforce. And this transition unstuck a whole lot of unions. Too often, one of the things that you confront when you're an organiser and you're organising in non-English speaking workplaces is that you have to be very comfortable to walk in and communicate to workers who do not speak the language that you speak. And there are unions who hit that challenge and they worked out ways to build a union in there alongside workers. And there are unions who walked away from that and said, this is not comfortable space for us to be in and we need a political fix to this organising problem. Our union was the one that went in and actually did the first, right? We went and organised with workers. So here are some of the rules or lessons that I kind of wrote down this morning, and they're not in any particular order, and I'll give you some examples. The first one is, as an organiser, as a union leader, as anyone, delegate, member, you have to be very uncomfortable and you have to always put workers first in the heart of your organising. Organising isn't about the worker who does not understand what you're saying or what you're doing. It's whether you as a union understand the worker and where they're coming from. So let me be clear. Workers understand absolutely everything you say and do as an organiser, even if you do not speak the same language. They see it in your actions. They see it in whether you care about what is happening in their workplace to them and you are going to do something about it with them and make a plan. And the role of the organiser is actually that, to basically understand where workers are and to go to workers and put them at the heart. And to give you just a really, it's one of my favourite examples of unions, asking unions to stop controlling workers and instead to start actually giving them the freedom to do things. And this is an example that I was part of. In a workplace in one of the farms, we had a real problem with the company. They didn't want to recognise the union that the workers had joined. We were going to bargain. We'd won a majority support petition under the current laws. And the company refused to pay any of the delegates to come off work to bargain for their agreement. completely refused. This is a majority migrant workforce. They'd won their petition. We had to make a decision about how we would approach that. And so one of the things that we did was we decided we'd invite every single member to the bargain. If we're going to meet after hours, because that's what workers had to do after they worked their shift to bargain, we would invite all the members and every worker on the worksite and say, you can all come to the bargaining. That is a very confronting thing for unions to do. Yeah, you are basically letting go of the control of who is in the room bargaining an agreement when you do that. So we did that, and it went from 9 workers to 20 workers, and by the end of it, we had 50 workers in the room. Yep. They went from 2 managers to 3, and the reason they brought the third manager is because we conducted the entire negotiation in the language that the workers were comfortable. So there were 5 different languages being spoken in that room. I did not understand one thing that was happening in that negotiation at lots of points, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter because the purpose of it was that the workers were the union. They controlled the bargain. They spoke to the boss, their boss, in the way that they needed to speak to them. And they were the ones running the negotiation. The point of it is that if you try to control workers, especially migrant workers, what you're going to end up doing is breaking the union, not building it. Number 2, unions need to make a decision that they're going to organise workers, and then they have to follow through. So if you want to organise and empower any workers, but especially migrant workers, but casual workers, gig workers, young workers, anyone, then you have to actually decide you're going to organise in the places they're working in, which may not necessarily be the places where are politically the places that you want to be. And it might be places that are very hard. And if you wrote down all the barriers on a piece of paper and the cost it took to organise farm workers financially and emotionally, most union leaders would argue not to do it because it was not sustainable. But that's kind of the point. Because if you want to organise workers and migrant workers, you need to go where it's hard, not where it's easy. And let's be honest, unions have lots of resources. They do, right? And when we want to campaign politically, they've got lots of money and people, but they magically disappear when it comes to organising workers. 10 years ago, some leaders did invest in farms, and we've built a union base. We actually have thousands of farm workers, and we started only with like 50, and we built that. And if my union had turned its back on those workers and chosen not to organise, then all those things that I said about what that sector was like would be there now. And they still are in the non-union places, but they're not in the places where the union lives and exists. And I do want to qualify that by saying there are forces both within and outside my union who don't like this brand and style of organising and would actually fight this particular campaign, and we're constantly having to justify our position. 3, a real union is based on trust and relationships. The success of this campaign, but the success of any campaign, really, in terms of organising, is when you build deep, genuine relationships with workers, relationships of trust. It's often something that gets really forgotten when we're talking about the theory of organising in unions. Relationships of trust matter between members, delegates, organisers, the leaders of unions. And I want you to think about what it actually takes for a worker who has no work rights and is afraid of being deported to come and actually tell you that and then to stand up. Or a woman who is being sexually harassed, who has not told her husband, her family, or anyone to speak to the union organiser or the union delegate about that. Or a cash worker whose entire life, job, accommodation, everything is based on that one contractor. You can't break any of that unless you are actually with that worker in their houses. That's why we house visit. You are actually part of that worker's life and they know you and trust you. That takes a lot of work. And you can't do that if it's a rotating pool of organisers and industrial officers that are strangers to them. You can't. It just won't happen. And I think that's one of the challenges that the union movement really has, is around building, like, deep relationships of trust. There are 12 women who brought the largest sexual harassment case in farms that we'd organised. Those women we've known for 10 years. We signed them into the union. I personally joined the leader of that group. We sat with them in their houses when the company threatened them about their union, and we ran a freedom of association case with them. We ran the mass meetings when we forced the CEO of that company to go and apologise to all those women and all those workers. We represented them when they fought rostering. We helped them when they did their wildcat strike. And we've run fundraisers for their family and communities when they've died at the job in Australia. So we know them, they know us, we're very much connected. They're the circumstances that led to that case being run. Without any of that 10 years, those women would not have run that case. And to give you, like, a very simple example of how, when you organise workers around this, how it actually builds a union and spreads it, one of the cases and underpayment case in Shepparton, not that far from here, with a farm worker was specific workers. They were being underpaid. They organised their union. They were threatened. Same kind of example. They ran their case. They won it. That woman who ran that case and organised the union is now the president of the Vanuatu Workers Union. And she helped organise the other women in the sexual harassment case. And those women in that final sexual harassment case in the settlement, when they got compensation, because they wanted a lot of other things, when they won their compensation, they donated back money to the Vanuatu Workers Union in order to set up a women's network, in order to continue to have women in the Pacific be union and stand up for their rights. That's how you build a union globally. You have to listen to the working class and you've got to unite them in the same fight. And I think this is actually really, really important, that if you want workers to fight, you have to start with where they are right now in their workplace. And I've heard this division over and over again in the union movement over all my decades, whether it's like casual versus permanent, young versus old, women versus men, migrant versus local, city versus regional, name it, I've heard it. And the thing is, there really is only one thing we should all be fighting, which is capital versus worker. That's it, right? And so I'll give you an example. In Geelong, there is a site where for over 10 years what had happened at that workplace, it was a very strong union site, had a union agreement. But what happened is the union, and by the union, the members at points with the union organiser, they allowed a group of workers to come in and not be covered by that agreement. And it was a small group of workers. And it was in an area of work that was probably pretty shit work. And so people often in lots of very manual industries will make exceptions, yeah, in their agreements about who's covered. That problem went from a few workers to hundreds of workers being outside of the agreement, it paid by contractors again in piece rates, and they happened to all be Vietnamese, bussed in from Melton. So I want you to think about this. You've got a group of workers, very proud union people who have fought for their rights, and then you have hundreds of workers from one particular community, not coincidence that the contractor is also from the same community, being paid in piece rates, being bussed in, sleeping in the toilets, providing their own knives at work while everyone else is being supplied something else, separate lunch. You can see what happens in a workplace, right? Some of that is expressed every day in lots of our union organising, and it's expressed in the rallies that we saw last week. It's these workers' fault that this is occurring. Who was responsible for this? The company. But for over 10 years, we struggled with this. We tried to force workers, the permanent workers, to fight for these workers, but the division was too deep. And so lots of myths came out about our members being racist. So I was asked to go in and help organise in the bargain with a group of organisers. And so one of the things we did, we just started really basic. We started with the delegates, we talked about the problems in the workplace. Then one of the things we built in was to actually have off-site meetings every Saturday morning and just invite as many members as possible to them and as many workers just to walk through and get them like ready, because we knew the only way we could break this was through a strike. But we also knew we were just far away from it. At the very first meeting that we had with workers in Geelong, workers came along and we talked about the problem of work and secure jobs in Geelong. And what these workers were very clear to me about was that, and they expressed it very well, once upon a time their kids could get a job in this factory, but now they can't. And that their area has got one of the highest meth addictions in Victoria, and their kids have no jobs, and their lives are shit. And so you can see how the boss's tactics play out in there. So one of the things I asked the workers was, well, what about if we got 100 resumes from all your kids and families and we went and like put that as part of the claim in the bargain? And they all agreed. And then I asked them, these contractors, should they also have a job? And do you care where they come from? Could they come, like, does it matter what nationality they are? And they went, oh no, we don't care about that, we come from all over the world. So the racism was broken in like one, with one question. Those workers organized their work site, got everyone to join the union. They went to the week before a strike over the idea of 100 secure jobs for Geelong and to get those contractors employed directly, and they won. On it, 2 weeks ago, I went to do this. I went to the mass meeting, and what we now have is Vietnamese delegates. We have members from the Vietnamese community, right? And all of the workers are in a mass meeting together, and they're talking about how they're going to get more wages for everyone on that site. Now, I just want you to think through, that comes from starting with where workers are and listening to them, and then putting in the steps that actually gives them the voice and control over their lives.
You're on Stick Together, workers' stories, union news and social justice issues. We finished the program with a small part of the well-attended anti-racism rally held on Friday the 26th of September in Nam on the grand final long weekend.
Okay, good afternoon everybody, and welcome to this rally called by the Refugee Action Collective. My name's David Glanz, I'm a RAC member, and I'd like to welcome you to this rally. The main target of the racist attacks has been migrants. Yes, they'll have a go at Indigenous people and refugees, but the main target has been migrants, and the anger that people feel about the cost of living crisis, about the housing crisis, is being sheeted home to people who didn't cause that crisis in the first place. No migrant is responsible for thousands of bank workers about to lose their jobs. 4,000 bank workers from just one of the big banks. No migrant is responsible for the failure of successive state and public federal governments to invest in public housing. Where is the public housing program to help the most vulnerable people off the streets and into decent accommodation? Migrants are not responsible for inflation. They're not responsible for landlords gouging tenants. They're not responsible for a taxation system that rewards people buying property and then leaving it empty because they get a tax break on the capital gain that eventuates. Migrants are not to blame for that at all. And yet we get told by the racists that somehow if we stop migrants coming into this country, everything will get better. Well, during COVID, not only did migrants not come into this country, people left the country, and the housing price issue was worse than it was than before the pandemic. There is no relationship between migration and housing. Migrants are our workers, they are our brothers and sisters, and they can be and should be and often are in unions. Today's rally is really just a start. It's a marker. We're putting down a marker that anti-racists are not scared to come onto the streets. and we had almost 60 organisations endorse today's rally, and I think it's significant that 10 of those were trade unions. We look forward to them mobilising more vigorously at future rallies, but the fact that they gave support was very, very significant, because in the workplace, everybody is mixed in together. Indigenous people, refugees, migrants, people born here from 2, 3, 4 generations ago. The workplace is a melting pot, and we all know that to build strong unions, you need to unite everybody in that workplace, regardless of where they come from, regardless of where they're born. So unions play a vital part in pushing back the racist agenda. So please make welcome from the Victorian Trades Hall Council, Danai Bosler, who is one of the assistant secretaries.
Thank you so much, comrades. Can I also acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Wurundjeri people of the mighty Kulin Nation, acknowledge this land was stolen and never ceded, and always was and always will be Aboriginal land, comrades. And if we care about fighting back against racists, and if we care about fighting back against Nazism and the far right, we must win treaties in this state. It is a disgrace that we are the last Commonwealth country that hasn't come to this, but I'm going to be proud when we are the first state that has treaty and treaties in this state, because that is one of the many things that they are coming after. So if you care for this cause, take up arms and support treaties. The campaign's on for the next month. Come up to Trades Hall to grab a T-shirt, a bag and a core flute, because we need to win treaties in Parliament this month, next month and for the years coming, because we know they're coming for our First Peoples and we need to stand in solidarity with them. And Trades Hall is proud to march and fight side by side with the First Peoples Assembly, and we're going to do it until we win all the treaties and many treaties more in this state as well too. I hope you will join us on that fight, comrades. Trades Hall is proud to defend rallies and public spaces in this city. And I want to be here with a message of hope, because at Trades Hall, we believe that we deserve the good things in life. We deserve bread and roses. We deserve food on our table, but we also deserve culture and roses and good things in our city. And we need to share them and embrace them and love them with all our comrades. But we have to fight for this. This good city didn't just happen by chance. It's because we talk to our neighbours. We take up their struggles. We stand with them in solidarity when they are fighting for a cause. We understand where they have come from. Unless you're First Nations, which I am not, we all came from somewhere else. I'm from a big, proud migrant family. We're proud to be from a big, proud migrant family. Migrants, there's like 30% of the Australian population now. Over 8 million people were born somewhere else. That's outstanding workers. That's the teachers and the nurses in our hospitals. That's the garbage truck collectors, that's the bus drivers, that's our doctors. These people, our migrant brothers and sisters, are contributing so much to our cause. And we will stand in solidarity with them. We will smash racism with solidarity, because unionists know that's the only way we win the fight. Nazis, the far right extremism, they're getting a platform. They're even in our mainstream political parties. They're even in the Liberals. Let's call it out where we see it. Let's call out the billionaires who give them a platform on which to say what they, the racist things that they want to say.
Seem like bad news all the time. We got blood and fires and wars and crime. They try to tell me who I ought to blame, but I know who it is, cause it's always the same. But don't be ashamed if you get confused when you talk to your friends or you watch the news. They try to tell you where it all...
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.